This is Lawrence Tuning, and these are my 88 friends.
Me and my 88 friends. Me and my 88 friends. I will sing you a song that will help me along. They're my one-man band. I'm the number one fan. Me and my 88.
Welcome to episode 156 of our podcast, Me and My 88 Friends. This is Lawrence Tuning, your host. This episode will air on November 18th, 2023, which is a Saturday night. We're only one day away from our big concert that we're doing at Abundant Life Church in Florence, South Carolina. My wonderful band, let me stop right there. I'm looking at my friend Brian Hoogenboom. And I always feel weird when I say my band. It's our band, but I don't know what to call it. It's Lawrence Tuning and Damascus Road. So maybe I'm Damascus Road's wonderful lead singer. I don't know. But anyway, I heard a story one time, Brian, about this man who married a rich lady. She was a widow or whatever. And he was poor, but he married up. He married a rich woman. And he kept telling his friends, come over and let me show you my farm. Let's take a ride. I want to show you my field, my cows. And it really irked his wife. And she said, honey, you got to stop that. This is not your farm. It's our farm. You remember, I'm the one who had it first. Well, he didn't learn his lesson. He kept saying, come see my farm. So finally, one day she had enough. And he told his friends, jump in the truck. Let me show you my pond, my fishing pond. So when he came home, she was armed and dangerous. She had a rolling pin in one hand and a frying pan in the other, and she beat the living daylights out of him so badly that he laid in the bed for like 3 days. And she started feeling guilty, and after about the third day, she said, honey, I'm scrambling some eggs and making some grits. Would you like to eat supper with me? And he said, oh, honey, that's so sweet of you. Just give me a minute while I put on our overalls. So let me rephrase it now. Our wonderful band, Damascus Road, and Lawrence Tuning, are doing this concert, and we're just going to look at the life of Jesus. This kind of an odd joke to talk about this, but we're going to look at the life of Jesus. We're going to gaze at his life. It's the only concert we've done all year, and I just hope you can come. They are going to put it on Facebook Live under my name, but that's not going to be the same as being there. It's Sunday night, which is tomorrow from when this broadcast comes out, November 19th, 6 o'clock, Abundant Life Church. The address is 3030 South Irby Street. That's I-R-B-Y, Florence, South Carolina. So I want to start this episode with some music from Damascus Road and Lawrence Tuning. And both of these talk about just the wonderful experience of looking at Jesus and focusing and talking about him. The first song is called I Don't Want to Keep You Hid, followed by When My Eyes Are On You.
Catchy tune. said she'd see what she could do. But there was just one problem. She said those words are much too bold. Could you tone it down just a bit, or we'll never get it sold?
When my eyes are on you, and your grace is in view, if I stumble and fall, I can quickly stand tall. When my eyes are on you, there's a place peace, where the struggles have ceased. I can quickly go there anytime, anywhere, when my eyes are on you. Let me see your face. Let nothing obstruct the view. Just one glimpse of your grace is all I'm asking, asking of you.
Our guest tonight is Jim Cook, who has been a pastor for 42 years. I've known Jim since he was a little boy. He's 3 years older than me, but his father was the first pastor that I ever remember. He was there from 1950 to 1956, and his mother and father made an indelible mark in the lives of the people of that little church in Lee County, South Carolina, called the St. Andrew Church of God. That's where I came to know Christ. This is the third part of a series we've done called Back to the Source of the River. I wanted to honor this place where I came to know the Lord and the people that influenced my life. The first episode, we interviewed the current pastor of that church. Last week, my grandson and I, Dalton, I took a trip out there, and we talked about different events in my life. So we're rounding it out this week with talking to Jim Cook, whose father was a wonderful pastor, and Jim has followed his father's footsteps. I was thinking about this one time, and I was particularly about Jim's dad, who was named Revere Cook. Vance Havner wrote a book about his experiences as a young preacher in the mountains, I believe, of North Carolina. And this little church that he pastored had been pastored by a man many years ago, but everyone kept talking about him. And everyone referred everything to him. And he began to ask, what was it about this man that everybody thought was so special? He asked an old farmer, was he a great speaker? He said, no, he was okay, but he wasn't great. And he finally said, well, tell me, I don't know what is the secret, why this man was so revered and respected. And the old farmer stood for a minute, and he said, well, he loved us. He just loved us. And that's what I remember about Jim's father, Revere Cook. And Jim has had a wonderfully productive life as a pastor himself. So I want to go to a telephone conversation that Jim Cook and I had on October 2nd, 2023. I'm talking to Jim Cook, who will forever be known as Jimmy Cook to those of us who knew him as a little boy. And Jim has been a pastor for a number of years, and it's just a great joy to have you on the phone, Jim. How you doing, Jim?
I'm doing great. I'm doing great.
One reason I wanted to call you, I was thinking about my spiritual roots, and I grew up in the church. I grew up in a church your father pastored, and out in the country in Lee County, South Carolina. And I've talked to so many people that have bad memories of church. Church was boring, or they didn't like church. But I was absolute opposite. I loved church, and I figured it out that a great reason why I have such wonderful memories is your family. They were just outstanding, your mom and your dad. And then, of course, you guys were our age, and I just don't have a bad memory at all of the time that you guys lived here, you know, in my boyhood. Your dad's name was Revere Cook. Your mom was Margaret.
Yes.
And, of course, your sister, Jeannie, was my first girlfriend.
I didn't know that. I didn't remember that.
Yes. She was five and I was four.
I have all kinds of memories from South Carolina. And it was a good place for me to kind of get a start.
Yeah. You
know, to meet people who loved each other and figured out ways to put up with each other, you know, and I just have good memories. And of course I was just a kid, but I was really grateful for the congregation there. Maybe I didn't realize how much at the time, but looking back, the church really did help me believe that God cared about me.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, your dad, and I say your mom too, because they were a real team. The thing I remember about him, he was so accessible to everybody. He was not distant at all. I don't know if you remember this, but every Sunday night after church, your family would come down to our house. We were one of the only families that had early families that had a TV.
Mm-hmm.
And they would come down and watch every Sunday night, What's My Line? They would pop popcorn. Mm-hmm. And they had figured out this beverage where you mix grape juice with ginger ale. Do you remember that at all?
Yep. I remember eating ketchup sandwiches at your kitchen table.
Oh, boy.
I remember Carolyn liked ketchup sandwiches. We'd have ketchup sandwiches. I remember going to your house and watching things long before we ever had a TV, being able to watch TV and just hanging out with you kids and just being there was a good memory for me.
You were the oldest one. You were the oldest one of all of us. And
I don't know if you remember. I mean, I got all kinds of memories, but one time we were at your house, and you tricked my sister Carolyn to sit in your wagon. And as soon as
she went downhill,
there was a big ravine behind behind your house, and so the minute she got in there, according to her, you pushed her.
And that sounds about like something I'd do.
And she ran into a tree.
I didn't remember that part.
And she came up crying, and according to Carolyn, your mother spanked you right in front of everybody.
Of course. That's the way it worked.
So I also remember you had a friend who ended up marrying my cousin, Steve Corbett. You and Steve were friends. And I was told not long ago that your dad took you and Steve somewhere. You were just riding around with him. And he gave you a dime a piece or whatever and told you to go in the store and buy some candy. And, of course, the Church of God, especially back then, had this hard rule against tobacco, against smoking. So here comes Steve with a pack of candy cigarettes. And he puffed them all away. And your dad was not very happy with with his choice. So what other things can you stand out in your memory when you look back during that time?
You mean memories?
Yeah.
I remember there was that mural in the front of the church at St. Andrews.
It's still there.
And Lonnie Stokes used to sit in the back of the church and trying to figure out where the best fishing spots would be.
That sounds like him. Yep.
I don't know if it was the Jordan River or what it was, but he told Dad later, he said, I think I found a pretty good fishing spot there.
Well, the title at the bottom says The Land of Galilee. And I've been to Galilee. It doesn't look at all like Galilee, but anyway.
Do you remember those barbecues out in the back where that permanent barbecue pit was dug?
Absolutely.
And once a year, I don't remember what they did. I raised money for missions or whatever they did. Do you remember a guy named Josh something?
Josh Holmes. He was an African-American gentleman that lived up the road. And he had his own pit at his house. But the church actually built their own barbecue pit, if you remember. We had our own.
Yep. And he would come the day before and get the coals going. And, you know, I don't remember how they got the meat in there, but I remember it was kind of one of those all-you-can-eat.
Oh, yeah.
Rice and barbecue hash and barbecue.
Yep.
Whatever, iced tea, sweet tea, and all you could eat. People come from miles
around. Oh, yeah. That church became known for that. Nobody can make barbecue like Josh Holmes either. I mean, he was very gifted. How old were you when you accepted Christ or made a decision to follow Christ?
I was 12. We lived in Tennessee at the time.
Okay.
And Jeannie and I gave our hearts to the Lord at the same time.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
And I remember where you moved. You moved to Elizabethton. I remember we came up and saw you there.
That's right.
How old were you when you felt like you were called or felt like you wanted to enter the ministry and become a pastor?
Boy, that's kind of a long story. The short version is that when I was a senior in high school, I had some vague ideas about studying to be a doctor, medical doctor. But there were some things, small things, that kind of made me at least consider ministry. I had a long talk with Dad one night, and he was the last person I should have talked with about that topic with, because his prejudices would have been, you know, of course he'd be happy to see me consider ministry. But I told him there were a couple reasons why I didn't think I could even consider it. One was that I hadn't had, you know, the sky didn't open up and a scroll drop out written in Hebrew saying I ought to do that.
Yeah.
And the second reason was it was too much responsibility.
Right. Because you saw it your whole life. You had an inside view.
Yeah.
Of what
and
a pastor
said,
is.
You don't. He said you could think of it as the Lord opening doors for you and guiding you to take one step after another, and you could start thinking about ministry, and the Lord will either confirm that or he'll show you something different, but he'll guide you. I think it was his way of saying you can't steer a parked car. You know, you keep taking it step by step and see which doors the Lord opens up for you. And regarding the second objection, he said, you don't have to do it by yourself.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like it's your ministry. It's the Lord's ministry, you know, and it's your life belongs to him. And if you're going to consider, if he's showing you, you know, that maybe the ministry is the best thing for you, then keep trusting him and he'll keep guiding you, basically was his good advice, and that made sense to me. I didn't have to have drums and trumpets and
right.
a parade to convince me. I just needed to keep being faithful and see what the Lord was going to do. And the more I trusted, and the more I went down that road, the more the Lord confirmed it.
Well, your dad was a very wise man, and that was wise advice. I remember the old days. A person almost had to know the exact moment in time they received the call, and it doesn't work that way all the time.
Well, it wasn't a Damascus Road experience for me. The Lord opened one door after another. I had a conversation with a friend of mine out in the parking lot not too long ago. About he was turning 65 coming up, and he said in his early adult years he did a lot of random things that seemed to be totally disconnected from each other, and it was like he was just zigzagging around with his life before he got into what he ended up doing for a working career, in communications and filmmaking and all that. And he said when he looks back now, it was all a straight line. At the time, some of those things he was doing seemed so random, but every one of those experiences and things he did, he needed to have that to be able to do what he ended up doing.
That's great.
At the time, he couldn't see it, but as he looked back, the Lord opened the doors for him at the right times, on schedule, even though he couldn't see it at the time, and it was all a straight line. And I feel like my life has been kind of like that.
You grew up a pastor's kid, a PK, and I've heard horror stories about that experience. And you were part of, in your growing up years, what, about five churches? You went to Tennessee, then Louisiana, then Florida. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I'm sure each church was different. But what was it like being a pastor's kid?
Well, there were a lot of expectations, as you can imagine. My folks had expectations of how we ought to behave, and church folks had expectations, and I had my own set of expectations over time, you know. And I, over the years, you know, that as I look back, had I been a doctor's kid, they wouldn't have expected me to do surgery.
Right. Absolutely. Yep.
In my case, I'm firstborn. So, you know, firstborn people tend to be rule keepers and, you know, overachievers and so on. And I suppose it fit my place in the birth order. But I didn't find most of those expectations to be too onerous.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to. I didn't want to embarrass my parents. There were times when I got off the trail, you know, but I didn't want to embarrass the family, and I did want to live a decent life.
Yeah.
And when I became a Christian, I wanted to do that for the Lord. It wasn't just because the expectations were there,
right?
But because I was trying to honor Christ.
We grew up the time frame that you lived there. It was the Jim Crow era and segregation.
Yeah.
And I just have such high regard for your mom and dad. I told you when I contacted you to see if you would be on the podcast that your parents, and this is really, really true, set the bar for what a good pastor should be like. Every pastor that came after them, they would always be compared to Revere Cook. Tell me if I got this right about your dad. I don't know about your mom, but didn't your dad go to Oberlin College?
He did.
In Ohio?
Mm-hmm.
And did your mom go to college?
She went for a couple of years to Anderson College.
Okay.
And they got married after she, when they got married, they moved off to serve churches.
Yeah, okay.
But well, she was there a couple of years.
Well, during that time, we're talking about even before 1955 with the bus boycott in Montgomery. This was hardcore segregation days in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But I found out that the president of Morris College, which was a historical black college in Sumter, he and your dad went to college together.
Yep.
And even though the times were so different, they got together privately and continued their friendship in the Deep South during the Jim Crow days. And when I found that out, I just thought, that is so wonderful. And that's so predictable, knowing the person your dad was.
My sad memory from South Carolina is that they bussed us white kids to an all-white school. And they gave the school down the road, what, a couple miles down the road, they gave it to the black kids, and they bussed us white kids.
Yeah.
All the grades on one bus. Remember?
Oh, yeah.
We had seniors in high school and first graders all on the same bus. Imagine that. That's an education in itself.
And the bus driver went to our church, Sanford Lee.
Yeah, the bus driver was, what, 18?
Oh, yeah, back then you had student bus drivers.
Yeah, and so they bussed us to Ashwood Central in all-white school.
Yeah.
And as I look back, that's pretty sad for me. I never went to school with a black kid until I was in college.
Yeah, because you lived in the South for most of your life.
Yeah, we moved from South Carolina to Tennessee to Louisiana.
Yeah.
So, that's not a happy memory for me.
Right.
But to this day, Lawrence, it shouldn't be shocking. I don't want it to be shocking, but when I go into a little cafe in Louisiana and there are black families eating in there, it shouldn't surprise me. I don't want it to surprise me, but it does a little bit. Because I remember the old days.
Because we remember the old days. We remember the old days. We sure do.
Yeah, those are kind of painful memories.
Yeah. But I thought it spoke a lot about your dad. In his own quiet way, he couldn't take on a whole system, but his own quiet way, he showed that he gave dignity to people that sometimes didn't have dignity. Now, your dad, I want to say just one or two more things about your dad, then we'll move on. But I don't remember him being a loud pulpit thumper kind of preacher.
He wasn't.
He was more thoughtful. When you guys moved away in 1955 or 6 or whenever it was, the guy that followed your dad was John Conley, who was in his early days.
Yeah.
He was a fiery...
Stem winder.
He was. And, we didn't have air conditioning back then. You had the windows open. And there was a man that came in my dad's store after you guys moved away. And he said, oh, my goodness, I was walking down the road and I heard your new preacher preaching. I could hear him all the way out on the road. And he said he was really preaching. And then he spoke about your dad. He said, I love Reverend Cook. I just thought Reverend Cook was the greatest thing around. But he said, you know what? He said, I never thought he had quite enough vitamins to be a preacher. I think he meant vitality or whatever. But
no, Now we've gone from theology to energy.
Yeah.
You're listening to our podcast, Me and My 88 Friends. This is Lawrence Tuning, your host. We've been talking to Jim Cook, who has been a pastor for over 40 years and who was the son of a pastor. I want to play a song called Feed My Sheep, which is a song that honors that calling of being a pastor.
I saw him preach last night, this man who touched my life. The years had all flown by since I came to know him. He was an old man now, his hand was still on the plow. I realized last night what a debt I owe him. And I asked him, how do you do it? How do you just keep carrying on? Then he told me, here is the secret that keeps me strong. Late in the night, when I lie down to sleep, I can still hear a voice, tender and sweet. You did not choose me, I chose you. You make me smile when you do what I called you to do, when you feed my sheep. Feed my sheep. And he had done just that. When times were good or bad, he had some battle scars, but he just kept fighting. He never did retire, he never lost the fight. And there he was last night, letting the light in. And late in the night, when he lies down to sleep, he can still hear that voice, tender and sweet. You did not choose me, I chose you. You make me smile when you do what I ask you to do, when you feed my sheep. Feed my sheep. And I thought of all the others who preach the word week after week, weary and discouraged, yet they continue to speak. What is it that keeps them going after all their strength is gone? Could it be they still remember that voice they heard when they were young? And late in the night, when they lie down to sleep, they can still hear that voice, tender and sweet. You did not choose me, no, I chose you. You make me smile when you do what I called you to do, when you feed my sheep. Feed my sheep. And so they feed his sheep.
Let's return to the conversation I had with Jim Cook a few weeks ago. Do you remember the electric train you won at my dad's store?
I do remember that. And your folks were afraid that somebody who won that thing was not even going to have any electricity in the house.
Yeah, I always wondered if they rigged that thing to let their pastor's son get it.
I don't know.
I don't think they did, but you know what? I would go to that store because it was the train was in. By the way, if people don't know this, my dad owned a grocery store, and so he had all these gimmicks, giveaways, and raffles, and, but that that train was in that store for weeks, and I was just crazy about that train. I just longed for it, but I knew I couldn't win it because I was.
Well, you could have played with that train, didn't you?
I did come up to your house.
Play with it,
But when you got it, I thought you were the luckiest guy in the world that Jimmy Cook got the train.
I remember in South Carolina when the library truck would come around.
Yeah,
do you remember that?
Oh, sure.
They would let us check out books, and we were signed up for the weekly reader and the record of the month club and all that kind of stuff. For kids, because we were pretty isolated, and they made sure we had opportunities and resources.
Yeah.
And that, you know, I didn't realize it at the time, but looking back, they read and they bought us books and they wanted to make sure that we had some opportunities. Yeah. And I've not forgotten that.
And I haven't talked much about your mom, but she was just... Oh. As you know, was just a wonderful, wonderful person. She had a singing voice all her own.
Mm-hmm. She did.
And I remember one thing that they used to tease her mom about. They had a little trio at the church, and of course my dad sang in it, and they were asked to sing at a funeral somewhere. And they were running late, so everybody just hauled, piled into the car, the 53 Pontiac. Mm-hmm. And your mom wasn't thinking. She got in before my mom, and so she's sitting in the middle between my mom and dad, and she didn't even notice it till she was down the road about 15 miles, and all of a sudden she was just horrified. She said, I can't believe I'm sitting between a man and his wife. But
I remember that 53 Pontiac.
Yep.
I remember your dad driving down the road out in the country, and he'd be looking back at whoever was sitting in the back seat.
Oh, yeah.
So he's in the front driving the car, looking back and talking to the people in the back seat.
The car's going all over the road. Yep.
Laughing. He had that big laugh. I remember that like it was yesterday.
Now I want to talk about you a little bit. I've never told you this, but I've always looked up to you all my life because you have just been an outstanding person and just creative. And, of course, we went to college together after all these years, Jeannie and you, and then I knew Larry when he was there in college. We kind of reconnected. We kind of stayed in touch over the years. But I remember how do I say this? You just were very creative. I remember one time you tell me if I got this right. Didn't you drive a bus in Chicago just to sort of get to know the regular people and know kind of how they lived?
You're giving me way too much credit, Lawrence. I drove that bus because I needed the money to pay for school.
Okay.
It was the best money I could make in the summertime to get me through the next 9 months. They gave me a lot of overtime. And what happened was they had to have full-time temporary drivers to replace the people on vacation in the summer. So they hired us university people to drive buses. They trained us how to drive them, and they hired us and got good pay, and I could make enough in the summer if I worked a lot of overtime and stayed with it to basically get through my 9 months of school to pay tuition, room, and board. Now, if I'd lived cheap and I learned ways to do that, so I wish I could say it was because I wanted to get to know people in the community and all that. I did that, by the way.
Yeah, I'm sure you did. I'm sure you did.
That was at least half my education.
Yeah,
I was driving for the CTA.
I remember your dad.
In a neighborhood that a lot of suburban people wouldn't drive through.
Yeah, I remember your dad telling us about that. But you also called my dad, who was a cotton farmer. And, of course, people don't pick cotton manually anymore. Mm-hmm. But, that was the way it was picked for, mm-hmm. Centuries.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what a lot of people don't know is that some white people pick cotton, too. You know, a lot of the families. But you call, and you must have been in seminary by this time. You ask if you could come down and pick cotton. Do you remember that?
I remember that. I picked 20 pounds, Lawrence. I was out there in that hot sun. I think I picked 20 pounds, and that sack had hardly enough to feel the weight.
And back then, it was 2 cents a pound, so you made 40 cents.
Yeah, exactly.
But you wanted to know what it was like so you could have empathy and identify. And I always thought that was a great character quality that you had, and I've always looked up to you. And, of course, I remember, this probably won't go on, but I felt so sorry for you in 1970. Remember the International Youth Convention? You had a multimedia presentation that had popular music blending Christian themes, and there was a contingent that came walking down the aisle singing "Give Me the Old Time Religion." You handled it very well, but I thought I wouldn't want to be in that guy's shoes right now.
Well, I was kind of stunned, as you can imagine. whatever speech I had in my mind disappeared. Probably just as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was pretty disappointed because the guy who led that, I had been in a conversation with him. Students who decided to get together who knew we didn't agree with each other about everything. We got together just to talk. And he and I were kind of at either end of the spectrum. But I remember his saying, we reach our hands in fellowship to every blood-washed one. I remember his saying, we reach our hands in fellowship to everybody who put up with us. And I love that because I thought, okay, yeah, that's kind of the point. The Lord gives us each other in the church and then says, okay, figure out how to love each other.
Yeah.
You know?
And that's easier said than done sometimes.
I'll give you the love to do it with, but you gotta practice it.
Yeah.
And I really appreciated what he had to say. And then when he kind of led that protest, it was disappointing.
Oh,
We weren't trying to, ruin the young people of the church. We were just trying to be creative.
Yep.
But I guess he didn't get that.
You've been married to Carol how long?
52 years.
52 years. And, of course, I knew her in college.
Mm-hmm.
I knew her parents. So when you graduated from Anderson University, which we call it now, what year would that have been, about?
68.
And then did you go to the seminary in Anderson?
Yeah. I went to seminary in Chicago. That's what I was doing.
That's why you're driving the bus. Okay.
Earning my way through school.
Yeah.
I went to Christian Theological Seminary on the University of Chicago campus.
Okay.
I went there not because I didn't really support our seminary in Anderson, but because I'd been there 4 years already, and I thought I ought to see how other people. I already knew what I thought. I want to hear how some other people thought.
Yeah, you were always, I guess that's what I'm getting at. You were kind of always an explorer, exploring different avenues and that sort of thing. So, okay, you got out of seminary, what, in 71?
Mm-hmm. I graduated in Chicago on Thursday night, and Carol and I got married on Saturday night. She graduated from college on Monday night. And we moved to California within the week.
My
goodness.
Go sit in
our first church. It all happened at one time. You couldn't get too nervous about any one thing.
Oh, my gosh. That's incredible. So your first church was in California?
Yeah, Corona, California, between Riverside and Anaheim. The church was, Lawrence, it was just tiny.
Yeah.
And we went out there, been a church established a long time, and they'd had some ups and downs. And they wanted a seminary graduate. And there's a fun story behind that. I don't know how much time you got.
I got plenty of time. I got loads of time.
Well, we in about January of the year I was going to graduate from seminary, which would have been 71, I sent a letter to my friends saying, it's only January, but it's already January. We don't have a place to go. I've asked this woman to marry me. I have no idea where we're going. If you hear of anything, let me know. Didn't hear a peep from anybody. And I got, long story, but I got a guy was going to pick me up. He was driving back to Chicago from Alabama, and he was going to pick me up at the airport, and we were going to drive together up to Chicago to seminary. And we had one of those freaky late snows in April, I think it was. And he paged me just after Carol dropped me off the airport. She went back to study for some major tests and left me at the airport. No cell phones, nothing like that. And they paged me just after she dropped me off. And it was this guy on the phone saying he'd spun out down something.
Oh, no.
Vienna, and he couldn't drive. He was going to get a motel, and I just had to figure out something else. So I gave it an hour, called Carol up on a payphone, and I was just talking with her when Robert Reardon and H.L. Baker were walking up the corridor.
And hey, for those that don't know who we're talking about, that was the president of the college.
Yeah.
And the treasurer?
Well, yeah, one of the staff people.
Yeah.
And so I flagged them down and told them I needed a ride back to Anderson. And they gave me a ride. And on the way back, Bob Reardon said, "Jim, about time for you to start looking for a church, isn't it?" I said, "Yeah." And he said, "What are you looking for?" And I told him. He said, "Well, if I hear anything, I'll let you know." And the very next week, he was at some kind of alumni rally out in Garden Grove. And the entire search committee from the Corona Church showed up and asked him to give them some names for seminary graduates. They were looking for somebody young, and they wanted a seminary graduate. And he gave my name.
Wow.
And they said, we want some other names. And he said, "No." He said, "If Jim Cook won't come, I'll give you some other names."
Oh, what a nice guy. And what a divine appointment for you to cross paths. So,
you know, you can't make something happen. It must have been the Lord's doing, because you can't make something like that happen.
So you were at the airport, and they were at the airport.
Yeah, yeah. And I was stranded. So I'm just asking for a ride back, and we had that conversation. So
that's something.
So, there's more to the story, but I flew out there in May, early May. Remember, we're getting married in June, and I had sold my car to buy Carol an engagement ring. So I was hitchhiking back and forth from Chicago to Anderson to see her every once in a while, trying to keep my classes up.
So literally putting your thumb up in the air and hitchhiking.
Yeah, exactly. So here I am going back and forth because I sold my car. She's wearing a 61 Volkswagen on her left hand. And so I went out to visit them, and I spent 4 days out there, and they wanted me to come. And Carol and I, you know, we loaded everything we owned in a 9x5 U-Haul trailer. You can't move a girl into a college dorm in a 9x5 trailer anymore.
Isn't that the truth?
And we most of that was books and clothes. And we got out to the West Coast, and we were just married. The church wanted us to come, and the Lord blessed that. There were some good things that happened out there.
So how long were you at that church? I know you moved later to Michigan.
We were there for 8.5 years, and then we went to St. Joe for almost 11 years, and we're in Columbus for 13 years. And we've been here for 20.
That's a lot of years to pastor, and I always heard that if you're a pastor, you've got to have the heart of a lamb, but the hide of a rhinoceros. I've asked this to other pastors. What do you think's the most rewarding thing about being a pastor of a local church, and what do you think the greatest challenge is?
The reward is seeing the progress that people make, to see people come to Christ, to see lives transformed, to see people growing in their faith. That's the reward. To feel like, you know, you can see places where the Lord's working.
Yeah.
In people's lives individually, and in the church as a whole. That's rewarding. The hard part is when change doesn't seem to be happening.
Right.
And there's regression, and you know, a lot of people don't seem to be getting it.
Do you think it's a lonely job?
Sometimes it can be really lonely, but you know, it's only if you don't see that there are people who really want to be supportive. If you isolate yourself, it's really lonely, but you don't have to be totally isolated. There are some decisions that are lonely decisions. You got to make a call, and they're hard calls to make.
Yeah.
And you know, somebody's got to make them for the good of the church and for the good of individuals. You know, you try to protect the sheep, but it doesn't have to be lonely in terms of support. You know, Carol and I have been in small groups just about everywhere we've been, you know, and if you're going to encourage everybody to be in small groups, then you ought to have the right to be in one yourself.
Well, I hope you'll tell your lovely wife hello for me. We went to college together, and everybody used to say, what a cute couple they are. I guess you still are. So I hope you'll tell your siblings hello, too. It's been great talking to you, Jim. After all these years, it's a wonderful thing to know somebody your whole life and be able to reconnect. And I noticed on Facebook you always have a quote of the day.
Mm-hmm.
What's your favorite quote? Give me a couple of the quotes that stand out in your mind.
Well, I've got so many favorites. You want to hear the one for today?
Yeah, give me the one for today.
Probably haven't time to sing it yet.
Yeah.
The one for today is from Bell Hooks. I am often struck by the dangerous narcissism fostered by spiritual rhetoric that pays so much attention to individual self-improvement and so little to the practice of love within the context of community.
That's a good one.
Isn't it, though?
That's a good one. We read it one more time, and we'll go out with this.
Okay. I am so often struck by the dangerous narcissism fostered by spiritual rhetoric that pays so much attention to individual self-improvement and so little to the practice of love within the context of community.
That's great, wise words.
Yeah. So. Have you noticed when you go to church, have you noticed that too many of the songs are about me?
Oh,
and
absolutely.
Not enough songs are about us, are about we.
Yep, I sure have.
Have you noticed that?
Yep, sure have. Well,
you know, it's just not. It's not just about me and my sweet Jesus. You know, you start there. It is a personal relationship with the Lord. But if it doesn't include other people in the church, and for that matter, people outside the church, if you aren't loving them, you know, did you miss the point?
You did miss the point. sure did.
Yeah. Well, this has been a blessing, Lawrence.
Oh, me too.
I hope this is not one of those conversations where you don't talk to each other for 40 years and then you go for another 40.
I don't think I got 40 left.
I would like to stay in touch.
I would too. And this has been great. And
it's been a blessing. Can I pray for you before we get off the road here? Lord, thank you so much for Lawrence. Thank you for his life. Thank you for all the ways you've used him over the years. And you're still doing that. We're so grateful for your love and grace at work in his life. And that's so clear to so many people. I pray that you'll continue to bless him beyond what he could ever hope for, and help him remember that his life belongs to you. You've already done wonderful things through him, and you'll keep doing it. Help him remember that. That's how it works. Lord, there are some times when we run out of words, but you know what we'd say if we could. Sometimes our hearts are so full and words are so inadequate, but you know. You know our hearts. Please look deep into our hearts and help and realize how much we want to love you and want to show our gratitude by the way we live. And we want to love each other. In Jesus' name we pray.
Holy fire, fall on me. Give me strength for the task. Take me high, close to thee. This is all that I ask. Here I am, send me forth. Feels aright. Time is short, hear my plea, fall on me, holy fire. Holy fire, just fall on me. Give me strength for the task. Take me high, close to thee. This is all that I ask. Here I am, send me forth. Feels arrived, time is short. Hear my plea. Fall on me, holy fire. Holy fire, just fall on me. Give me strength for the task. Take me higher, close to thee. This is all that I ask. Lord, here I am, send me forth. Feels arrived, the time is short. Hear my plea, fall on me, holy fire. Hear my plea, just fall on me, holy fire. Fire.
That's our show for tonight. Special thanks to Jim Cook. And as always, special thanks to Brian Hoogenboom, who was our trusty engineer. Thanks for listening. God bless.
My idiot friends, I will see.